Good Black Friday morning to you. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. In this hour, we'll talk about the need that food shelves are seeing in northeastern Minnesota and northwestern Wisconsin with Shay Morris, executive director of Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank. Plus, Anna Serafin Smith with the National Retail Federation talks about consumer spending this holiday weekend. And we'll also talk with Douglas County Board Vice Chairman Jim Payne, who announced his candidacy for mayor of Superior this week, now that Bruce Hagen has resigned. Hagen is serving as interim mayor until the election of a new city leader in April. Plus, WPR is teaming up with the Twin Ports Diversity Partnership to host a listening session on diversity issues in the region next week. Dr. Maria Stalzer-Wyant-Kuzo and Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander join me to talk about their hopes for the partnership. We begin today's program with Shay Morris, head of Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank. Second Harvest provides food to 180 pantries, shelters, and other charitable organizations across 8 counties in northeastern Minnesota and northwestern Wisconsin. And I spoke with Morris earlier this week about what she's seen as far as the need for food assistance in the region.
So if you look at statistics overall, actually we're seeing kind of a good trend in that numbers are stabilizing. So it means we're not seeing, you know, kind of during that Great Recession, we're not seeing the huge spikes in demand. We're seeing some leveling off of that, which I think is a good sign. I think it certainly speaks well of kind of what's happening in our region in terms of employment or unemployment, I guess, and the numbers are good. So we're really seeing some positive numbers in terms of just the need.
I bet that it's been a lot of work for you trying to provide all those resources to the shelters when that demand is really up there.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, definitely it's taken more resources in the last few years to make sure that we're food to those extra people that needed help during that time. And still, I mean, need is still high. We still estimate our food goes to about 44,000 people in our region each year. So it's still a pretty high number. And also when you look at like food insecurity statistics, you know, we see in our region, in that 8-county region, we're serving a higher need in terms of people declaring themselves as food insecure compared to the state average in Wisconsin and Minnesota. So when you look at this area in particular, we do have people that really need that extra assistance.
And what are some of the reasons for that? I know you mentioned things seem to be stabilizing, but what are some of the reasons that they're still looking to the pantries and organizations and you to provide that?
Yeah. And certainly, even though unemployment is low, we do have a fair amount of unemployed people that receive our assistance. We also have underemployed. You know, we talk about that quite often. Is their wage or their household income able to support their family or seniors on a fixed income? That can be a challenge. So we see a little bit of that. It's kind of a whole lot of factors that really determine the need. You know, home heating season, medication, utilities, those things can all drive people to really needing extra food assistance because the money is just not covering all of those expenses that we all have to handle.
And around this time of year, you know, do you happen to get more requests for food from those organizations or what do you see around the holiday time?
Yeah, you know, certainly I think at the holidays, agencies, especially our food shelves or the soup kitchens, are trying to prepare more food for the holiday season. You know, whether that's in the form of meals or groceries that people can take home. You know, I know at our direct service programs over in northwestern Wisconsin, we're providing turkeys at the holidays just so that families can, you know, experience what we all experience at the holidays, which is, you know, you can bring your family together and actually provide a good meal. So that certainly requires more resources this time of year. I think demand, especially, you know, in the last few days, our weather's starting to chill down a little. It means people are putting on their heat. And, of course, then they start thinking about what is this winter going to be like and am I going to be able to afford home heating? And then, again, we talked a little bit earlier about medicine. I mean, this is the time of year we hear about colds and flus and, you know, what is it taking for people to be healthy? So it is probably a higher demand time of year, not only because of the holidays, but just because it's starting to get cold outside.
Yeah, we're all looking to keep the heating costs down, I bet.
Exactly.
So as far as, like, the need for food, though, you mentioned that you're giving out turkeys. Do you have, like, a number as far as how many you've handed out to either pantries or just have available?
So it looks like we've provided turkeys to over 400 households in northwestern Wisconsin.
So it's, like, direct delivery? It's not through the pantries?
Correct. Yep, correct. Okay. So that does not count, like, if we provided them to, say, like, the Barnes food shelf. This would be our mobile food pantry program. We're actually assisting people in southern Douglas County, so that operates out of Solon Springs. And then over in Iron County, we operate the Iron County Mobile Pantry Program. So those are people that we've actually touched directly with those turkeys. Every month, we operate two mobile food pantry programs in northwestern Wisconsin, so again in Solon Springs and Hurley, where we go into a community where demand is particularly high. There might not be a food shelf. There might not be access to a lot of meals in that community. So basically, every month, we're coming in with a truckload of food. We have participants that are registered typically through extension or through our own volunteers. And then they basically drive up to our truck. We're able to provide their family or their individual household with food for the month, you know, partial food for the month. And then they go back to their homes and we bring our truck back to Duluth, hopefully empty. So that's the mobile food pantry program. Ooh. And again, that does not count all of the turkeys or holiday meals that are provided to the food shelves that we partner with. And, you know, whether it's in Ashland or Poplar or, you know, Barnes or Bayfield, those are all communities that have food shelves that we partner with too to provide food during the holidays.
And you usually are getting your food from stores, right? Like Area Super One and...
Yeah. So we rescue foods both nationally and regionally. So we, of course, being a member of Feeding America, they actually help us secure national donations of products, whether it's big companies like Conagra or Jennie-O or Del Monte. Those are companies that align with Feeding America to make sure that food is mobilized, you know, pretty much in every county of the United States for people in need. And then regionally, we, of course, do our own work of rescuing, like you said, through institutions, whether it's, you know, the hospitals or schools, grocery stores, retail grocery stores, or, you know, places like Sam's Club and Super One. Those are all organizations that align with us. And then we rescue their surplus foods as well. So it's all kind of different donors. And then even like Upper Lakes Foods, you know, there's a good example of a wholesale in our region.
So, I mean, is like some of that what you're bringing in, like food drives or anything like that? Or
you know, because it's kind of a strange situation, but we have a food shelf here at Second Harvest that serves Hermantown residents and communities north. So we will sometimes get food drive product. But if somebody called us and said, hey, we're going to have a food drive over in Bayfield, Wisconsin, we want Second Harvest to say that food to get that food, we'll say, you know what, that's the food that we'd really like you to give to your local food shelf. Because really, Second Harvest sees its role as providing food that locally food shelves wouldn't get without us. So if it's a local food drive, they'd get that probably anyway. So we don't really need to be involved. But we want to make sure that we mobilize other food for their programs.
Well, is there anything that you're hoping for as far as like meeting the demand of the pantries or shelves or other organizations that you serve?
You know, usually we're looking, you know, we've tried to put an emphasis on healthier food. So if people are donating products through a food drive, you know, we look for like low sodium products or, you know, instead of heavy syrup, maybe a lightweight, water, you know, for like our canned fruits, you know, things that are, again, low sodium, low fat are preferred just because we're trying to make sure that we, you know, impact people with good health as well. So we're trying to just distribute foods that are high in sugar and high in fat. So our role is really to try to, you know, make people think like that. We collect information from all of the regional food shelves that we serve. We know right now that over 80% of the food they're distributing in their local community is coming from Second Harvest. So that says a whole lot of food is being mobilized for local communities. But one of the things we often hear is, you know, like somebody in Bayfield or somebody in Ashland will say, you know, when we send them a direct mail piece, they'll say, I give to my local food shelf. And we say, that's good, and you should do that. But realize that Second Harvest, even though we're located in Duluth, we have impact in local communities because we're mobilizing a whole lot of food. And that, for us, takes resources to do that. So we're always trying to educate people that even though we're in Duluth, we have so much impact in those in northwestern Wisconsin communities.
Well, and I know before, too, you said that you serve around 44,000 people in northeastern Minnesota and northwestern Wisconsin.
Yes.
Do you know about how many pounds of food that you bring in each year?
Yeah. Yep. So annually, we rescue and distribute about 5.5 million pounds of food. That's what we're on track for 2016. If you put that in terms of meals, which is a little bit easier for people to understand, that's probably about 4.4 million meals this year that we'll provide through our distribution of food to agency partners and people in need.
Is there anything I'm missing that you would like to add, Shay?
The only thing that I'll say, like a trend that we're seeing, it's interesting, like when we're comparing Northwest Wisconsin to Northeastern Minnesota, that really, I mean, proportionate of those served, it looks like children are about a third, about 30% in both states. Where we see really an interesting trend for food shelf service is that in Northeastern Minnesota, there's about 7% of people served by food shelves are seniors. Over in Wisconsin, we're seeing that as high as 17%. So it seems like there's a greater proportion of seniors in northwestern Wisconsin that are getting their support through local food shelves.
Have you been able to ask shelves or pantries, like, why that number? Well, I mean, are there more seniors living?
Yeah. It's interesting to look at, and I should say that does include not only the food shelves, but also our mobile food pantry program. And we do see kind of just a higher proportion, especially at our mobiles, of seniors, and I don't know if it's because of the type of service. It's a little bit more discreet in terms of you're driving up to a truck to get your food. You don't have to actually go into your local community, which for some small towns and for seniors who are very proud, that's really difficult for people. So I'm assuming that part of the number is really related to kind of that mobile pantry service versus just food shelf service overall.
Again, you were just listening to Shay Morris, Executive Director of Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank in Duluth. Given that it's Black Friday, some people were staked outside stores in the wee hours this morning to take advantage of deals. I was certainly not one of them, but I spoke with the National Retail Federation's Anna Serafin-Smith earlier this week about the shopping rush this holiday weekend.
We're seeing about 137 million consumers are planning to shop this Thanksgiving weekend. That number is about 2 million more consumers this year compared to last are planning to enjoy sales on Thanksgiving Day, Black Friday, and even Small Business Saturday.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, too, because I thought I saw a news article last night on NBC News that was saying that last year in-store shopping was down either on Thanksgiving or the holiday weekend. And so are you seeing most of the shopping occur in stores or online, or where's it happening?
Based on our studies, we learned, especially last year, consumers spent half of their time in store and the other half online. So they are leveraging the online shopping experience to read reviews, check out the deals, look at all the ads. And then the other half of the time, they're actually going in store and seeing if the gift that they're planning to purchase, whether for themselves, for the family, or in other loved ones, is the best deal, is the best product and deal that they could find in store. It's a mix of both nowadays. We call this definitely a modern consumer shopping experience. It's very different than what it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, consumers didn't really use online to look at reviews and other things like that. They just went in store and kind of base it off of the sales reps and maybe even family feedback. And now it's a completely different environment in the way consumers shop.
Okay, and what are you expecting for the actual Thanksgiving Day, Black Friday, and then Small Business Saturday?
So we are seeing that for Thanksgiving Day, numbers actually dropped a little bit this year. We're predicting about 21% of shoppers are going to go in on Thanksgiving Day. That number is down from last year at 22%. This year for Black Friday, about 74% of shoppers are going to be shopping on Black Friday, and then followed by 47% are heading to stores on Saturday. And then of which that particular number, 24%, are actually going in to support Small Business Saturday. So that number is higher from last year, where we saw 22% of consumers saying that they were going to shop to support Small Business Saturday.
Okay. And as you're looking ahead, too, to Cyber Monday, what are you expecting for that?
We're definitely expecting a little bit of a boost this year for Cyber Monday. Last year, 34% of consumers said that they were planning to shop on that day, and this year we're seeing around 36%. Cyber Monday is also evolving like how we've seen with Black Friday. Black Friday sales started as early as November 1st, and now we're seeing Cyber Monday sales starting as early as on Black Friday. So this is part of this, retailers reacting to this modern-day consumers and how they're shopping.
And so I'm also curious, are we seeing more stores closing for the Thanksgiving holiday, kind of a return to the traditions of the past, or...?
One of the things that we're noticing this year is that there's definitely numerous retailers that are closing their doors on Thanksgiving Day and opening on Black Friday. So, yes, they are going back to their traditions of let's keep the doors closed, but something that's very different now compared to the past is that although their stores are closed, their websites are open. So a lot of these retailers that are planning to close on Thanksgiving Day, their websites will be running Thanksgiving Day promotions. And so you can still shop at your favorite retail store that's planning to have their doors closed. But you could do it from the comfort of your sofa right after you enjoyed a delicious Thanksgiving meal.
Well, and I also was curious, you said 2 million more shoppers this year. And is that kind of an indication that the economy is doing well, or why do you think we're seeing more shoppers this year?
So definitely one of the factors that is making this a successful holiday season is the economy. We're seeing a lot more employees in the work field or workforce, and wages are starting to slightly go up when we compare it year over year. And those are really positive signs. Consumers are very happy with the way things are running right now in our country. So when we see all these factors, it's starting to show even in sales. Retail sales from last month to this month have boosted. And we definitely think that that trend is going to continue on for the month of November. And it's definitely one of the main reasons why we're seeing more consumers excited to go out on Thanksgiving weekend and shop and start their holiday shopping and continue on the tradition of what it is to shop on Black Friday.
And any advice for shoppers who may be taking time at the stores or online this weekend?
One of the things that we definitely recommend is to read every single ad that's out there. And there's some really, really great deals. Retailers are being very aggressive with their promotions. So it's really right now consumers we recommend them to not only look at those ads, but do some price comparisons, see how much those items that are on sale on Black Friday, how much more discounted they are on Black Friday versus any other time of the year, and see if it's worth that particular deal. And if it is, you take advantage of it, especially if it's at the price point that is best for you. That's one thing that's very different. You know, in the past, retailers were putting price point based on what's best for the industry. Now it's more what's best for the consumer and what they think that the consumers are more than likely to pay for a particular item.
So do you think that you were going to see overall, you know, looking ahead to Christmas too, more shopping this holiday season?
Definitely. You know, the Thanksgiving weekend is just the start of the shopping season for the holidays. And we know that this is going to continue on all the way till that Saturday before Christmas. So Christmas Eve, some stores are planning to be open that day. And we'll see some last-minute shoppers go in and buy their loved ones some gifts that day before Christmas Day comes around. Some of these sales are more than likely to still continue throughout the next couple of weeks.
I know I'm queen of procrastination, so I'll probably be one of them.
I'm probably going to be one of them as well, although I'm more than likely will take advantage of some deals for this week, especially for myself.
Again, you were just listening to Anna Serafin-Smith with the National Retail Federation about their survey on consumer shopping this Thanksgiving weekend. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll speak with Jim Payne about why he's running once again to be Superior's mayor. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. Good morning, I'm Danielle Kading. Glad to have you with us. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Almost a month ago now, Superior Mayor Bruce Hagen announced he would be stepping down early as the city's leader.
I will be fulfilling the responsibilities of the office of mayor until the end of April of 17. And I want to dwell on that a little bit. I'm announcing this resignation, if you will, today to facilitate sufficient time for those that want to consider running for mayor to do a self-examination and look at the process, the election, as to what they can bring to the table, what passion they have for our community, and go for it.
Well, Douglas County Board Vice Chairman Jim Payne announced this week that he's in. Payne is the first to announce his candidacy for mayor, and I spoke with him by phone about why he's decided to run again after Hagan defeated him in the 2015 election.
My decision, both last time and this time to run, really has nothing to do with Bruce Hagan. I was really running for the office. I felt that I had a lot of experience in local government in the 21st century, which is had unique challenges, but also superior in the 21st century has unique opportunities. I thought it was really the best time to start building that kind of future for Superior. So that's why I wanted to start talking about those ideas then. That's why I pursued the office in 2015. That's why I'm pursuing the office now. I think I have even more experience now. I expect to be the most experienced candidate in the race, and I certainly believe I'll be the most qualified.
And you have experience in public government, as you've said. Right now you're on the Douglas County Board. You're the vice chairman of the Douglas County Board. And is it 7 years that you've had experience in the public sector?
Yep, a little bit more than seven as an official member of the county board. But, I mean, even as a student at UWS, I did some student work with the county board and other local governments. I've been involved in Superior Days since my time at UWS. And of course, you know, I served in the Marine Corps before that. It's not government service, but it's, you know, I feel like I've got this commitment to public service that goes back my entire adult life.
And so what do you want people then to take away from you as a candidate for the next mayor?
That I am building a vision for I'm building a bold 21st century vision for Superior. So I don't want to think about just the next couple years. I know this is just a 2-year term we're running for, but our city really needs to think about the next 30 years. That's something I said 2 years ago. It's something I still believe today. We need to focus on both our big challenges, but also the really big opportunities and take some risks to build a city that works well for everybody, but takes advantage of changing demographics and changing technology and changing economy. So I want people to know that I am the candidate for the long-term future of Superior, that we want to really look forward and build something great in this town.
So are there some risks that you've identified that you'd like to take a chance on for the city's economic health and viability moving ahead?
Yeah, of course. I'm a big supporter of Better City Superior. I know that is a big project and it's a big investment, both from the private sector, and I believe the public needs to be involved in that investment. I also believe that we need to take advantage of some of these really unique opportunities that are happening across the country, some even very close, like in Duluth. I think we need to start changing the way we do transportation infrastructure in Superior. Our infrastructure network was built more than 100 years ago. It was designed for a very different purpose than people are using it today. This is something I hammered a lot in the last campaign. I'm going to talk about it again this time. People under the age of 25 are not getting driver's licenses at anywhere near the rate that older people did in previous generations. People just move around differently. So I think we want to slow down transportation, make it safer, make it more efficient, and emphasize different ways of getting around. Bicycles and pedestrians could become the dominant way of moving through a small city. So I want to invest in first a cross-city trail, but start expanding our access for all people in transportation. I believe that we can do a municipal Wi-Fi network. This is kind of a passion project of mine. It's been tried in other places in Wisconsin. It's worked well for businesses and communities, and it expands opportunity to especially students of all income levels so that everybody has access to information. I think this is an idea as big as libraries were in the 1850s and 60s. So I do want to take some of these chances and see what works, because I think small cities are the future of the United States, but only when they're willing to take chances and try some things like this.
So are those the priorities that you're running on right now, or are there other things that you hope to accomplish if elected as mayor?
Absolutely. I have a full platform on my website. It's jimpayneformayor.com. And the platform focuses on kind of two things. One, we have to address the challenges that we face, things like we have a very serious drug problem in Superior, and our budgets are very, very difficult because our relationship with the state of Wisconsin has not been great. Our economy is changing very rapidly. You know, we are slowly moving away from an industrial commodities-based economy in northwest Wisconsin, and we need to be able to adapt to that. So I want to make sure that we're tackling these challenges as carefully and deliberately as we can, and looking for innovative solutions that bring everybody on board. But I really do want to explore all of these opportunities. I should say, just the things that I'm running on are not the only things that I hope to accomplish, if that makes sense. The biggest thing I want to run on is that we're all in this together. I want to be a mayor that works with the city council and the county board and the school board and development and activist groups across the city, as well as regular citizens, so that we're all looking for new ideas that can make that can improve our city. So my ideas are not the only ones we're going to accomplish. This is good. This is going to be a partnership with everybody.
Well, and I know that the outgoing mayor, Bruce Hagen, has said that he thinks that it's time for somebody young or at least some fresh blood to come in and take leadership of the city. And I'm definitely sensing that in your voice, Jim. I mean, you've got the enthusiasm. It may be just that you've had multiple cups of coffee this morning.
Well, both of those things are true, yes. But I tend to talk like this when I start talking about politics, especially in my community. I am very passionate about this. Local government is not glamorous, but I've really, really enjoyed doing it for the past 7 years. There really were no accolades for running for the county board at the age of, I think I was 27 when I first ran. It's a chance to do good service, and it's a chance to look around and take satisfaction that we really made a difference for our community and for future generations. I agree with the mayor that new, fresh blood is great. To me, it's more about we need new ideas. I think experience is still very important in this office, but we need to try different things. And people from different generations have different perspectives. I know that the generation that is growing and raising families now in Superior and across the country views our country and our small communities differently than people did 50, 60 years ago. And so we need to build a community for the people that are going to be living in it for the next 50 to 100 years.
Well, and you're the first candidate to announce that you'll be campaigning for the position of mayor. In the past, you ran against Kaylee Hermanson and Greg Mertzig and Mike Herrick, who have all had some form of public service here in the city of Superior, and it remains to be seen whether they would throw their hat in the ring or others might come forward. But what's your game plan, or what are you planning to do as you run your campaign?
Well, like I said about Bruce Hagen, I really don't want to run against any person. I want to run for the office and talk about the ideas that I have for Superior. I have a hard time being a negative campaigner, most importantly because I just really fundamentally respect anybody that wants to take on something as difficult as a political campaign or as difficult as the office of mayor and improve their city. I really do think that that's a good person that tries to do that. So I guess, Danielle, I have a hard time disliking any of those people. So I'm not going to run against them. I am going to run on my ideas and for the things that I want to see in Superior. I can tell you I do believe that I'm the most qualified candidate in spirit. I think I'm going to have the most support. I think a lot of people are on board with the ideas that I'm talking about.
Well, I'm sure we'll have more to talk about in the months to come, but anything that you'd like to add?
That we're all in this together. You know, this has got to be a campaign and eventually an administration that brings a community together. This is not going to be about me. This is really going to be about all of us in the city of Superior and what we can do together.
Well, I appreciate you taking time to talk about your announcement this week about running for mayor, and I hope you have a good holiday weekend.
Hey, you too. Thanks a lot, Danielle.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Again, you were listening to Douglas County Board Vice Chairman Jim Payne about his announcement this week that he's running for the office of mayor in Superior. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but stick around. There's more to come. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. Good Friday morning to you. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us. Next week, WPR is teaming up with the Twin Ports Diversity Partnership to host a listening session on diversity issues in the region. I spoke with Dr. Maria Stelzer-Wyant-Guzzo, who is a professor and program coordinator of the Legal Studies Criminal Justice Program at UW-Superior. She talks about the background of the partnership and why it was formed.
The Twin Ports Diversity Partnership emerged out of a concern that our community began to gather together in order to foster inclusion, equity, and diversity in proactive, positive ways. And I started some invitations to different people, including Leslie Dolan, who became our moderator for the Twin Ports Diversity Partnership. And that in turn led to an informal invitation and meeting to many members of the community who might have an interest in those topics. So we have gathered now a couple times over the fall. There are over 20 people representing different organizations, groups, agencies within our region who all have a very strong commitment to trying to do positive, proactive initiatives that will foster diversity, inclusion, and equity in our community.
And so what prompted you to kind of pull everyone together around diversity issues here in the region?
I think watching what is happening in other communities with law enforcement community issues, with the I'm embedded in the justice system, and so there are many inequities that different groups and members of the community perceive happen with our law and justice system. And my general work with workplaces around the region, where many local employers, public and private, are seeing generational changes, increased diversity in the workplace, and everybody right now is in a really critical moment where I think we can embrace and be very proactive and positive about the value of diversity, equity, and inclusion all through our lives right now. And I think that's really what motivated the reach out. We had no idea here at UW-Superior how many people might respond to that or be interested. So it's been very exciting and very heartening to see so many people from different areas of the community coming together, passionately committed to trying to figure out how to do this in a good way.
And what are you hoping will come from some of the meetings that you've been having with the partnership?
Well, the first thing we want to do is get clear about what members of our community are thinking and feeling about these issues. And that's why the Wisconsin Public Radio listening session is such a great opportunity point for the community. Second, along with listening and learning, the second thing I hope for is we will be able to come together and agree around a mission of what can guide our work as the Twin Ports Diversity Partnership. And the last thing I hope for is, as early as next spring, that we are putting together a set of initiatives that can reach out and provide our community a chance to learn more, talk more, and take actions that show a strong commitment to these principles.
And, you know, I'm just thinking of the situation in which all of this is taking place after a very hard-fought and contentious campaign for the presidency, and now with President-elect Donald Trump taking over. Do you kind of feel like these conversations are more important now than ever, maybe?
I think that the election and all the conversations that have gone into that, the intensity of the election and the basic reflection of some of the divisions in our communities has springboarded, created a launch point for communities here at the local level to really begin a meaningful dialogue about diversity. It's not a new dialogue from my point of view. The opportunities and the challenges of diversity, equity, and inclusion is a longstanding dialogue here in our community, around our country. So I don't view this as a brand new conversation at all. I do think that the election has provided some unique opportunities for us to have deeper, meaningful, authentic conversations here at the local level and probably in broader settings as well for people to really examine, you know, where are we at and how are we going to operate and live together with respect around these issues and work together for meaningful solutions. So I tend to be one of those people that the election is certainly a provocative thing, and I think it has amplified issues that have long existed within our community, and I hope people see that for the opportunity that it is to have great dialogue and take some meaningful steps so that we can all move together, live together, and understand each other at deeper levels. That's what I hope for.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk, Maria. Is there anything else that you would like to add that I haven't asked you?
I would like to say that Wisconsin Public Radio is a great education force in our local region, and I appreciate the leadership that Wisconsin Public Radio always provides to be on the cutting edge of discussions and to bring news to our local community. So I very much value the listening session that will be coming up, and I hope the community takes advantage of the opportunity to be heard and to speak.
Well, we certainly appreciate the ability to work with the partnership on trying to get some feedback from the community about what their thoughts are. And I think that you're right. It's just going to continue that conversation.
Yeah. And we have great opportunity points that are available. So thank you for your part in helping, Danielle.
Yeah.
Very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kuzo. I really appreciate it. Again, that was Dr. Maria Stalzer Wyatt Kuzo, professor and program coordinator of the Legal Studies Criminal Justice Program at UW Superior. Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander is also a member of the partnership, and he offered his thoughts about why it's important to hold these meetings and talk about issues surrounding diversity in the Twin Ports.
Well, one, I think it helps build partnerships. I mean, there are key community leaders in there, whether it's from law enforcement or government to activist groups and people that are out there to, you know, ensure that there's fairness for everybody in our community. So one, it builds those relationships. So when there are problems, hopefully, it opens the avenue or the doors to have discussions where, maybe a lot of things can get resolved that way instead of, being an issue out there that the stakeholders don't know about. And, sometimes those things tend to fester and grow until, something bigger happens. So I think it's a nice mechanism to hopefully, open up channels of communication, build relationships, and hopefully be able to address issues before they have to, escalate or grow into bigger problems.
And I know that the partnership is kind of in its early stage and has had a few meetings so far, but what are you hoping comes from discussions with community members about issues surrounding diversity?
I guess my ultimate hope is that when we do identify areas where there's some marginalized groups or disparities, that we can get the individuals that would be involved in that particular issue to, kind of be open-minded, look at them and see, is there policy changes that need to happen? Are there changes in law that needs to happen? Or just a different attitude, perhaps? For me, a lot of my journey the last year and a half or so as chief, and including with this Twin Ports Diversity Partnership, is about learning the perspective of others, learning some of the historical context behind some of the mistrust that people have with not only law enforcement, but maybe government in general. And by having a little greater understanding of that, I think it makes it easier to recognize, that there are some hurdles here to overcome, but working towards that is the right thing to do.
Well, and I know that you still have a ways to go with the partnership, but what are the next steps for the group?
So the next step for the group is, we've been having monthly meetings, and I think in December when we have a meeting, we're probably going to discuss, do we need to lengthen the time of the meeting so that we have more time together, or maybe commit to some half day or full day sessions, as we move forward to get things adequately organized and launched. But the next real step is going to be a community listening session on November 29th. And the goal there is there'll be members from the Twin Ports Diversity Partnership there, but really in a listening capacity to be there. We'll identify ourselves, give the general mission or goal of the group, but then to, give the community an opportunity to voice concerns, to bring up issues that they think are important that this group may be able to help address. For something like this to work, particularly the listening session, is to have participation. So for people who do have concerns that have to do with equity or marginalization of really any group. I mean, diversity, I think, sometimes focuses a lot on communities of color, and that's certainly an important part of it. But, you know, there are other inequities, too. They could be gender. They can be a bunch of other things. So just community participation, people coming and not being afraid to, you know, bring up an issue and let us hear, you know, what those concerns are.
Well, it'll be interesting what community members identify in that meeting.
It sure will. I'm looking forward to it, though.
Again, that was Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander. WPR will host the Diversity Listening Session with the partnership this coming Tuesday evening at 6:30 at the Superior Public Library. That's 6:30 p.m. at the Superior Public Library. People of Color host Henry Banks will moderate the listening session. People can find out more information about it online at wpr.org/superior. Since it's Thanksgiving weekend, I was thinking about a segment that I'd heard about a year ago on the radio on WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge. It was all about cultivating an attitude of gratitude. Usually we all sit down during Thanksgiving and say what we're thankful for, but how do you keep that up all year round? I was pretty grateful to hear that piece and wanted to share it with you again now.
Give us thankful hearts, O God, in this the season of thy thanksgiving. May we be thankful for health and strength, for sun and rain and peace. Let us seize the day and the opportunity and strive for that greatness of spirit that measures life not by its disappointments, but by its possibilities. And let us ever remember that true gratitude and appreciation shows itself neither in independence nor satisfaction, but passes the gift joyfully on in larger and better form. Such gratitude grant us, O Lord. Amen. W.E.B. Du Bois on Psalm 100 from his book Prayers for Dark People.
That's our friend and colleague Cynthia Woodland. One of the things we're grateful for is her voice. Every religion in the world preaches gratitude. Some of the most beautiful poetry ever written, the most glorious music ever composed, was to give thanks. And today, neuroscience, cardiology, psychology, they all agree gratitude is literally good for you. It'll strengthen your heart, improve your mental health, lower stress hormones, maybe even make you live longer. So why don't we all just walk around feeling grateful all the time? I mean, I sure don't. I feel anxious and upset about the Paris attacks. I'm worried about climate change and ISIS, and I'm sad the Packers lost 3 times. So, time for a lesson in Nikon. It's a Japanese tradition or spiritual discipline that teaches people how to deliberately cultivate gratitude by noticing all the tiny little things we take for granted. Greg Creech teaches Nikon in Middlebury, Vermont, and he says if you want to give it a try, be thankful for more than just the turkey this Thanksgiving. Thank your roof, your furnace, even the lane lines in the street.
I think what I'm trying to suggest is that we look for a way to find special meaning in this holiday. We have, most of us in Western society, have such busy lives that we don't set aside any time for self-reflection or quiet reflection, stepping back from our life. And here's this one day that's set aside for a day of thanks. And what do? We make it into another busy day. You know, we rush around cooking and trying to get everything together and cleaning the house and having everybody come over, and then the TV is on and people are reading the newspaper, and we still don't have any time for quiet self-reflection and really being able to think about the things in the world that are supporting our life.
It's always struck me as that's the paradox of holidays, especially when you're hosting a gathering, is it does take a lot of time and effort to put it on, to get everything clean, to get the food ready. But of course, then the other side of it is that you can create a wonderful space, a wonderful atmosphere that other people can enjoy, but there, you kind of have to pay for it.
What we try to do is to just simply set aside a period of about 20 minutes before we ate the meal for everybody to go off into their own space in a corner of a room or sit in a particular chair and just do some quiet reflection on the past year. And we made some suggestions for exercises that people could do, but you could really do anything. One of those exercises was to simply make a list of all of the things that you've received this past year that have been really important to you. And even at a very simple level, like having a home and having heat in your home and having a roof on the house that keeps you from getting wet, and just make as long a list as possible. And then during the dinner, we had people just go around and talk a little bit about what was on their list. And it just created such a different environment in terms of gratitude and people recognizing how blessed their life was in so many ways.
You're really talking about a different mindset. You're trying to get us out of the, I guess what you could call the culture of complaint, and move into another arena, really the culture of gratitude.
Our life is very much shaped by our attention. If you think about our experience of life, if we come home at the end of the day and someone says, well, how was your day? And we start reading off a litany of complaints about what broke and what didn't work, and this person said something mean to me, and this person cut me off on the highway. By the time we finish that, our experience is, this has been a terrible day, and I can't wait till it's over, and thank goodness it's time to go to sleep. But when we do that, it's not because it really was a terrible day. It's because that's what we've paid attention to, and the fact that the coffee maker worked, or that the telephones worked, and the computer worked, and maybe our daughter came up to us and gave us a big hug when we came home from work. And because we don't pay much attention to those things and we focus on the problems, our experience becomes that life is just full of problems. And I think it's very much reinforced as soon as you pick up a newspaper or turn on the television set and the news is mostly about all the tragedies and difficulties in the world. But the cost of that is really our attitude, that we end up really taking things for granted and neglecting to appreciate all the things in our life that are really supporting us and helping to give us a good life.
So you're talking about saying thanks to inanimate objects, and you write about this in your book, Nikon, basically being grateful for the toaster, the toilet, the mirror over the sink, all the stuff that we take utterly for granted. You're saying we should thank them.
It's a wonderful way to shift our attention. I spent some time in Southeast Asia working in refugee camps where when you had to use the bathroom, there was basically a pit toilet. And anybody who's been camping knows what that experience is like. But I remember getting back from Southeast Asia and the first day that I was back going to the bathroom and flushing the toilet with this handle and just the sense of awe and surprise that I could just pull this little lever down and suddenly all the waste products that I didn't really want around had disappeared and there was this nice clean water that had replaced it. And it took a certain amount of deprivation of not having that available to me to make me really appreciate it. And I think that, unfortunately, that's the sequence of things for most of us, that we have these things in our life, including people, who we really don't appreciate until those things or those people are gone. And then we suddenly realize how much we miss them. And wouldn't it be nice if we can turn that around and really appreciate those things and those people, including toilets and socks and mirrors and our car starting and the lines in the middle of the road when we're driving to work that keep everybody in their lanes. Wouldn't it be nice if we could appreciate those while they're still there and not wait until they're gone?
Are you saying we should actually say thanks to these inanimate objects?
I think it's a good exercise. If you look at other cultures, it's not that unusual. I think in our Judeo-Christian culture, it may sound very strange, for instance, to say thank you to a pair of socks, for example. But if you look at other cultures, it's actually much more common in Native American culture and certain Asian cultures to see inanimate objects or things as having a particular spirit or nature and showing appreciation for those things. But whether or not you believe that, the actual act of saying thanks and expressing appreciation affects you. There's a little exercise that we do in some of the training that we do called garbage. And every time you're about to throw something away, you just pause for a second and you just say thank you to the garbage you're about to throw away. So, for example, I have a little wrapper here from a lozenge that I had in my mouth earlier. And that wrapper kept that lozenge fresh for me and for who knows how long. And so by mentioning thank you to that wrapper before I toss it into the garbage, it brings my awareness to the fact that this was an object that actually helped me and supported me in some way, which, as I do that throughout the day, really affects my attitude about my life and what kind of day I'm having.
You're really suggesting that if you make a point of saying thanks, you're going to have a more positive attitude. I mean, it's almost as if you do the behavior, a certain mindset will follow, and you're going to be happier.
There are essentially three things that I think keep us from really experiencing gratitude in our life. And one of those things is a sense of expectation. For example, you go into your bedroom and you turn on the light switch and you have an expectation that the light is going to go on. And of course it goes on, and so you don't pay much attention to it and you don't feel much gratitude for it. But when something happens in our life, particularly something pleasant or good that we don't expect, that tends to be what stimulates gratitude, right? We win the lottery, or we get a nice phone call from an old friend, or someone sends us a check for some money that they owed us from 20 years ago and we'd forgotten about it. When things like that happen, we have gratitude because we don't expect them. So one thing we can do is to try to figure out ways to essentially not expect things and therefore respond to them in much more of a surprising way. Surprise and gratitude are very connected. A second thing that I think keeps us from experiencing gratitude is too much self-preoccupation, too much self-focused attention. And the third area, which is an interesting area, is a sense of entitlement. If you feel that you're entitled to something, you can't really receive it as a gift. It's only when you have a sense that you're not entitled to something that the sense of something being a gift and therefore feeling grateful for it can occur.
Well, that last one is a tough one for Americans, because in some ways we live in this culture of entitlement, that especially given all the materialism around us.
Well, I think it is, and I think it goes very much against the grain of a lot of the self-esteem movement in the last couple of decades. The recognition of my own limitations and my own faults and my own mistakes really humbles me. And it's really that state of humility, that sense that I'm really not entitled to having good, healthy food today, and I'm not entitled to a car that works all the time, and I'm not entitled to having a beautiful, loving wife and a wonderful daughter. And it's the sense that I'm not entitled to those things that allows me to keep seeing them day in and day out with a sense of gratitude for them.
Greg Creech is the director of the Todo Institute in Middlebury, Vermont. He's the author of Nikon, Gratitude, Grace, and the Japanese Art of Self-Reflection. Steve Paulson talked with him.
Again, that piece was produced by the wonderful folks at To the Best of Our Knowledge, and you can find it online at ttbook.org. That's it for our program. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out. From all of us here at Wisconsin Public Radio, we wish you a happy, healthy, and safe holiday weekend.